Welcome to Boston Basic Income. I'm Alex Howlett. Can you guys hear me?
I can hear you.
Derek, you're supposed to say, I'm Derek Van Gorder.
I'm Derek Van Gorder. I'm new to this. I'm the recently added co-host, if you can't tell.
This week we have Steve Nunez and Michael Lewis joining us to discuss the welfare system. They recently wrote a white paper with Sidya Balakrishnan entitled Reweaving the Social Safety Net, The Best Fit for Guaranteed Income. And in that title, guaranteed income means essentially what we mean when we talk about basic income here on this podcast. So the question is, or there's a lot of questions, how does basic income interact with the various programs that make up the welfare system? To what extent does basic income solve some of the same problems that the welfare programs are designed to solve? And what does an effective welfare system and or social safety net look like in a world with basic income? This paper, just to give an overview, it breaks down a lot of the different safety net programs and it lumps them into two categories. So one category is income support programs. So these are programs that generally provide income or cash-like benefits to people who need that. And then the other category is insurance-like programs, benefits that only pay out when something happens. We've talked about the social safety net in here before and whether it makes sense to even think of basic income as a safety net program or something else. With that, I'll turn it over to Steve.
Very nice to meet you all, and thank you for having me. My name is Steve Nunez. Just by way of background, I'm a sociologist. I've been working in program evaluation for the last decade, and I work as the lead researcher on guaranteed income, which, as you said, is essentially UBI in the way that you're using it, at the Jane Family Institute. We're a fairly small and new organization, just about 5 years old. We started working in the design and sort of development of guaranteed income cash transfer pilots around the country, working in Stockton, Chicago, Newark, and now Compton with the Compton Pledge. From there, we've expanded out to try to get into sort of policy research. This paper is part of a series that is meant to explore the nuts and bolts of guaranteed income policy. As much as we love doing research on guaranteed income, as much as we believe that there's interesting things to learn about guaranteed income in terms of its frequency, the optimal amounts, how to build structures that get the money to people, we also think that a lot of the major problems, a lot of the major questions in guaranteed income and cash transfer research have already been solved. So we're not in a situation where should we give people cash assistance? Like, we just don't know. Maybe something bad will happen. Like, we're not there anymore. We're definitely at a point where we can move forward with plans to actually get cash into people's hands. This white paper series is meant to sort of do that, is to start thinking through what would this look like in practice? How would it fit into the safety net? What sorts of programs should it replace? What sorts of programs might be useful complements to something like a cash transfer policy? And what sorts of programs does it maybe not as well, you know, fit the mold of? So this is, I guess, a first attempt to think through those ideas and not to just simply say, you know, get rid of all welfare programs and replace it with UBI. It's more like, if we wanted to put a UBI in, what would we keep and what would we replace and what would we just jettison to produce, I guess, an outcome that people would find beneficial? That's just sort of background, and I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Cool. Yeah. So a question could be, what welfare programs, if any, does basic income make redundant? Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, this is Michael Lewis. I am also a sociologist, but in addition, I'm a social worker. I come to this as someone who's been writing about UBI for quite a while. I started doing this long before there was as much discussion about the topic as there is today. That probably colors how I see this topic a little bit and how I got into it. Because when I first started writing about basic income, UBI, there were a relatively few of us. At that point, there wasn't much discussion about the topic. And so a lot of what we were trying to do is generate discussion about it. I mean, there had been discussion about something like it before our time, and that sort of went by the wayside. And so our attempt was to just sort of regenerate some attention to it, some discussion about it. We, I don't think at that time, thought a whole lot about questions like how UBI would fit with the current structure of the welfare state, what should it replace, what should it not replace, and think like all the questions we deal with in the paper, admittedly, we didn't think that much about at that time, didn't say much about at that time, because we really had a different agenda for the most part, just getting it discussed again. Given where we are now, I felt, and that's why I got involved in this project, I felt that I and probably others should pay more attention to these questions. There have been people, even early on, who are UBI supporters, or at least sympathetic critics or supporters, the few libertarians out there who are supporters or sympathetic critics. they did attend to this question, and their view is that we should just abolish the entire welfare state and replace it with a UBI. But for the most part, in those early days, we didn't really attend to this question all that much, at least not in what I saw in the circles I traveled within. And so I just thought it was time for me to pay some attention to it and think through. And I don't feel I have all the answers. I don't feel the paper does either. I saw the paper as more an exploration of the questions and then proposing some ideas about how to think about the topic. That's sort of how I thought about it and how I still think about it so far.
Okay, great. I want to start with a question that came up on Twitter just a few hours ago with Steve. In a basic income world, what is the proper role of unemployment insurance?
This is actually something that comes up sometimes because we talk with folks who are, I would say, more on the sort of the libertarian side of the UBI world who do basically want to see most policies replaced. But in the paper, we talk about unemployment insurance as insurance is right in the name, right? It's a public insurance provision, and it's one where in the absence of government provision, it's unlikely for there to be a robust / complete insurance market. And given that unemployment insurance provides sort of a temporary but fairly deep support when dealing with what can be a very large income shock, and it does so by essentially the way that insurance mechanism does, by taking a small amount of money from everybody and using a risk pool to essentially transfer money, you know, horizontally. To us, or to me at least, that's the sort of program that guaranteed income does not replace easily. It does not replace very effectively. Because if you look at the current unemployment insurance system, and I think it's fairly stingy in a lot of ways, but it costs about, where recession is not taking place, it costs like maybe $50 billion, $65 billion a year, somewhere in that zone, right? So you get a fairly deep amount of support for the subset of individuals who are on what I would call like the right tail of the distribution in terms of bad things happening, right? Who have a very extended period of unemployment or multiple unemployment spells in a particular year. And I think a guaranteed income, if you made a large enough one, obviously could make sure that those people are not worse off. Imagine you got rid of unemployment insurance and you had the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. Well, then those people would be in a lot of trouble, right? Because $2,000 is not going to cut it. But if you're giving everybody $10,000 a year or $20,000 a year or something like that, you just keep building it up. Eventually, you're going to get to a point where basically everybody is sort of in a situation where they're not made worse off. But you're doing that at a very large cost and really at an opportunity cost. If you believe that there are other worthwhile programs in the safety net that need to be funded, that there are other things that the government should invest in, that's money that's being taken away from those things, unless we're sort of in a world where we are printing money and not worrying about inflation and so forth, which obviously is a macroeconomic theory that some people hold on to and that we don't get into in this particular paper. We're basically saying like holding a budget constraint, holding this constant, what can you do? A guaranteed income, it goes to everybody in the household. It goes to everybody in the household, even if they're not workers. And that's obviously very important. A UI system does not do that. And it leaves people who are outside of the workforce without aid. So it is absolutely not the kind of income support that we would like to see in the safety net, and obviously that a UBI could provide. But a UBI at the same time, sort of a constant income stream, is a very expensive way to deal with temporary extreme shocks. And that sort of extends in general to basically any situation where insurance markets exist or could exist, because you leave people having to anticipate what their needs might be in the years going forward. Am I going to be unemployed? If I'm going to be unemployed, how long is that spell going to last? How much should I save? Can I save? And that's a lot of burden to put on people, especially when you do look in the literature and you see that people are actually quite poor at guessing, at predicting how long their unemployment spells are going to be. And even when they get another job, the extent to which that job is going to replace, what percentage of the wages it's going to replace from prior to that spell.
So that makes a lot of sense to me. And I'm totally on board with the insurance and the risk pooling and the fact that giving everyone a fixed benefit doesn't solve that problem. But a question we can ask is, in a basic income world, what kinds of things do we need to insure? And is unemployment really one of those things? Especially as Bethany brought up in the chat, the importance of also having unemployment insurance depends on what percentage of people's typical income comes from their employment versus the basic income.
So there's obviously in economics the idea of incomplete insurance markets and the idea that there are just certain types of things that for a variety of reasons, will not be provided by the private market because of things like adverse selection or because it's too difficult to sort of predict what's going to happen, right? So like imagine right now, somebody who has TANF benefits, who has to decide, I only have 5 years that I can use. Should I take those benefits? I'm not sure. And then we had two once in a century recessions sort of back to back in a 10-year period, right? Insurance companies are basically in the same boat in a lot of ways. It's very difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen. Now, does it mean that unemployment insurance in particular is one of those things? It's hard to know, right? Because there is a public insurance system right now. So could you imagine a world where unemployment insurance disappears and private insurers manage to create a private market that essentially does what the current system does and does it such that a large chunk of the population is not effectively, you know, excluded from that? If so, and I've had this debate with Max Guinness on Twitter, actually, he seems to think that it's at least possible that the private market could provide in this situation. And if it does, and I say this in the paper, whenever there is a private insurance option, then just give people cash, right? Because then they can just buy the insurance. Like there's no reason to provide it if it's already being provided. At the moment, I'm personally skeptical that you could create a decent UI system privately, but I'm definitely open to evidence to the contrary.
I've seen some of those Max Guinness comments, and I tend to be on your side of the fence in terms of this debate. I agree with you that adverse selection is a big thing. It's hard to imagine there being a robust, universal, private unemployment insurance market. It's hard to imagine that being able to sustain itself in the private sector. But the question is that something that we need? I guess my perspective is a little bit different than Max's. I'm not optimistic that we can have a private UI market. I'm skeptical about, is basic income an alternative to safety net programs, or is it an alternative to people getting their money from jobs more broadly? And if that's the case, then would you need insurance against something that's no longer a central fixture of how people get their money?
I think the answer to that question, and also Bethany's earlier question, would depend on how big a basic income we're talking about. Because I think Bethany's point was about the proportion of one's income that comes from employment, from selling your labor. If you're talking about a huge basic income, whatever that might mean, and if one's income from work is a small proportion of their overall income, then I guess you could say we wouldn't need to worry about insuring against unemployment. But it's not clear to me that, first, I'm not really sure what the size of the basic income would be, right? And also depends a lot on sort of what happens in labor markets as a result of a basic income. And those are things I don't think I know. I don't think any of us know, right, for sure. But how much of our income comes from employment, how much employment there still is in such an economy, all that will depend on how folks respond to the UBI, how they respond to how it's financed and things like that. So I hear what you're saying, Alex, but I don't know the answer because I don't really know how basic income would affect all those things. So I don't know. But I don't expect a realistic basic income to be so large and employment in the short term to become such a marginal part of how folks get their incomes that you might not need an insurance mechanism for unemployment, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, to take it to an extreme, you can imagine an economy where we really do need everyone to contribute labor full time or as close to everyone as possible. And we really only make exceptions for the people who, for whatever reason, can't pull their own weight or something like that. And I think that's kind of the default that people assume in their minds.
I think so too.
So if we are living in that world and we are still living kind of towards that end of the spectrum, even in a basic income world, and the basic income is very small, then you would imagine that you'd need more of these safety net programs because we're living in a world where we need the incentives to be such that people do go out and work really hard and you only provide exceptions to people who have a legitimate excuse or something like that. In that case, you wouldn't have normal able-bodied people just living wealthy lifestyles or something like that without either having some wealth or going out and working or something.
Yeah, even I think if you go back to the, so the freedom dividend level of like $12,000 a year,
sure.
I don't even think that would be enough to have that kind of where the world is no longer centered around work on some level, right? Like, I think it would do a lot of good, right? There's so many people who don't work or can't work or, you know, shouldn't be working who basically get nothing right now or what they do get is gated behind other people's work, you know, like EITC style. And that's awful. And it's a huge, huge source of poverty. So providing that kind of, you know, everybody gets it and we're not doing this anymore. We're not conditioning on work. We're going to do as much as possible to start breaking that hold. I think that's huge. Obviously, it would have some effect on the labor supply. It would push wages up. And you could imagine some kind of, like, I guess, virtuous cycle whereby pushing up wages, it sort of maybe pushes, you know, more automation and then employment starts to cuts back again. And then the UBI goes up and so forth. But that's very speculative at this point, right? There's a version of folks are pushing for guaranteed income who think of it as empowering workers, right? We have this money. It's not enough to live super comfortably on, but it means that we can strike more effectively and we can withhold our labor in terms of extra hours and so forth. And employers have to respond to that. But again, yeah, it's work-centered in sort of the discussion, right? I guess I'm with Michael that it feels like, at least for the short run, where the short run being the next decade or two, that seems to be the world that we live in.
Yeah. I like to say that basic income is not a particular amount of money. It's a way of getting people money. Depending on how much money people get through that particular mechanism, things are going to look different.
One question I kind of wanted to bring up earlier, but I think maybe it'll be helpful here, is how much do we think that the term unemployment insurance is a metaphor for what's going on, or is that a literal description of what's happening? When we think of insurance, you know, I usually think of people purchasing this on the chance that this happens. If the government's doing that for you, is it really that different from just, say, the government paying money to people who find themselves temporarily unemployed? And when you frame it that way, it's not that dissimilar, right, from the basic income. You could sort of call the basic income income insurance, I guess. What's really being provided is income. It's not like they're employing you temporarily because you lost your job. They're solving the problem of giving you money.
The difference is that something's being lost and then made up for by the insurance.
Right.
There's also another difference too. I see the question you're asking, and I would answer that it's not exactly like private insurance, but it functions somewhat like it. The key way it functions somewhat like it, or one of the key ways, and where basic income, at least the proposals I've heard, would not, is that unemployment insurance, it's structured so that it replaces some proportion of what you earned up to a cap. And that varies by state. The cap varies by state, and how much it replaces varies by state. But there is some attempt to acknowledge what you made when you sold your labor. It's an attempt to replace that to some degree. So it is trying, like insurance, to smooth income, smooth consumption in a way that UBIs that I've seen are not structured to do. UBIs, it's a floor, and everyone gets that floor. But UBI doesn't really respond in quite the same way to what you've lost, the way unemployment tries to do deliberately. In that sense, it's like insurance. But unlike insurance, employers pay the tax to finance it. They may pass some of that on to employees and lower wages. And so the actual burden may not be on employers, but they are the ones that pay the tax by way of legislation. Whereas in insurance markets, the beneficiaries tend to pay their own premiums. In this case, it's paid for by the employers, right? But again, they may pay for that in lower wages or different benefits. So it is a little bit more like insurance than UBI would be, at least in the forms I've seen it.
Right. I guess where I was going with that is sort of wondering, I mean, I think that's all true, but I know that there's still, people have a lot of concern that people are getting paid not to work. And if we were talking earlier about incentive effects and that sort of thing, you can think of unemployment insurance, even though it's fairly controlled and means tested, that that can provide an incentive for people not to work. It's possible that by, I don't know if there's advantages. People sometimes think of basic income as creating advantages by simplifying that, taking that out of the equation. More relevantly, I think in the paper, I don't want to quote it because I might get it wrong exactly, but you were talking about sort of the best case scenario, the winners and losers of the insurance versus basic income, which I think is a good way of framing it. And you were saying, like, I think the best case scenario for the unemployment in some states was, I wanted to say 18,000 or 17,000 per year you could end up in if you had a very generous amount of it.
Yeah.
And so if you're thinking about just the Andrew Yang 12K baseline, you know, that would add up to a significant total difference, but the difference for the individual, that's not too far off. That would be a big difference for someone making that only that income.
Yeah.
But it seems like, is that the line where once basic income got close enough to that, would you feel it obviated the need for it? Or is there still a useful function where it's smoothing over a loss of income?
Yeah, it's tough because we didn't have the space, or I guess the time, to really do like a full out distributional analysis there. So there are states that have such amazingly stingy UI
right,
that basically everybody would be better off if they, I mean, even if you got rid of people wouldn't feel it in general, right? And there are other states like New Jersey or Washington State or whatever, where we're talking about a fair amount of money. The thing though, that then it often comes down to housing composition, right? Which a guaranteed income, at least the way that we're talking about, like a UBI, is something that would go to everybody, including to children, right? So If it was, frankly, an Andrew Yang-style program that only goes to adults and you just have one or two adults in the household, then the UI becomes a lot more important because it's just really not going to replace it. If you're now in a household, though, so imagine you are a household of four under a system where only adults get the UBI versus a household of four where everybody gets the UBI. In the second situation, you don't need to have an enormous UBI in order to handle the loss of UI under most circumstances. But then there's always these sort of tail situations where it's like, well, what about it's a two-earner household and it's a recession and they both lost their jobs and they've both been unemployed for 6 months and they live in New Jersey. Like, what kind of would you have to do in order to do that? We didn't really break down all those scenarios. I saw, by the way, there's a question that Joan put in here, or a comment, which is the welfare programs eliminated are those that limit choice, food stamps and so forth. And yeah, I mean, the paper is largely about that because we identify an enormous number of programs that are meant to do something like a guaranteed income in the sense that they're supposed to augment income, if not be the only source of income, like as say, like Alaska Permanent Fund Dividend can't replace all income, but it can augment it. It's an income support program. And the programs that exist in the US, whether it be TANF or WIC or SNAP, even to some extent, although lesser, to SSI, they have an enormous number of restrictions. They're very hard to get. They make you jump through an enormous number of hoops to remain eligible to receive it. And then in the case of things like housing choice vouchers or SNAP or whatever, they're just coupons. You can't actually use them on what you see fit. We generally in the paper recommend getting rid of most of those. Most of them are very small. It's kind of funny. If you took a pot of money and you said, I'm taking the same amount of money and spreading it across everybody, or I'm going to give very deep aid to a small number of people, right? That's the theoretical trade-off between these sort of targeted programs and universal programs. But in practice, the US targeted programs are actually really stingy. They don't provide much benefit at all. So providing a guaranteed income to folks would actually be a huge improvement. I think the only issue there, which we talk about and we don't have a great solution to, is that something like a third of households at or below the poverty line receive multiple benefits, not just SNAP, not just TANF or whatever. In our world, we're not going to get rid of Medicaid. So let's just take that aside and just say, what are the households that receive housing choice voucher benefits and also SNAP or and also TANF or whatever? And for those folks, there's a subset of them who are actually getting a fair amount of aid. Even if you were giving people $6,000 or $7,000 a year, maybe even $10,000 a year, you could get into scenarios where those particular households, that subset of them, could be made worse off if we got rid of all of those programs. And in particular, I think SSI and the housing choice voucher programs are the ones where they actually do, at least in some instances, provide very substantial aid. And it would be kind of dangerous to just, if you could wave your magic wand and get rid of all of those income support programs simultaneously and replace it for that subset of people. Ideally, in a real world, like, you don't have a hodgepodge of programs, but each of these programs, you know, $20 billion here, $40 billion there, are so small in terms of the federal budget. Should you even bother getting rid of them, or should you just lay a guaranteed income over them? That's certainly not the case with an EITC or with a SNAP or with a WIC, which are fairly large programs. But when you get it down to these much smaller programs, you might just leave them in place or create some kind of transitional program where you phase them out slowly while increasing the guaranteed income so that those people aren't made worse off.
I want to correct something Derek said, just to make sure no one leaves misinformed. So UI isn't means tested in the way we usually understand that term. It's not means tested. You don't have to be low income to qualify for UI. There are conditions for receipt, but that's not one of them. But it is true that how much you get depends on your earnings up to a maximum, but it's not really means tested. And the way we talk about these things, it's universal in that sense. And also something that Steve said made me think of a distinction we didn't make in the paper, but it's one that's relevant. We talk a lot about this in schools of social work. That's where I teach. I'm in a school of social work. And the social policy courses there, we talk a lot about a distinction that's often made between the so-called deserving poor and the undeserving poor. The programs that we've called income support more or less overlap with those programs that people talk about as going to the undeserving poor. Now, the people who use this terminology, they tend not to like that terminology. They're commenting on how the society regards these programs, not themselves necessarily, at least among my students. They aren't fans of that terminology, but that's how they understand the public viewing these programs. So these are programs that are like TANF, even Medicaid, right, to some degree, food stamps to some degree. So these roughly correspond with the programs that go to the so-called undeserving poor, and the social insurance programs roughly correspond or overlap with those that go to the deserving poor. And this distinction is really about sort of how much so-called work one has to have done or has to do to get the benefits, right? So that deserving, undeserving distinction is based on selling your labor, or what people commonly call work. And so another way to reframe what Steve is saying is that we pretty much come down on saying that the UBI is a way to address some of the things addressed right now by the programs for the undeserving poor, where the UBI does not make that distinction. It's a way of like saying they are as deserving too, right? So you give them this unconditional benefit. It goes to everyone, but from their point of view, it goes to them in a way that's not assuming that they're somehow flawed and undeserving characters.
It's not stigmatizing.
Yeah, exactly.
In the same way, yeah.
For that population, but of course it goes to everyone, right?
Well, it's not just that it's not stigmatizing, it kind of can't be, right? So any other thing that we come up with, we might get it wrong about who deserves it, who doesn't, and UBI, that's not possible.
Universality is important for a variety of reasons. This is maybe a little bit abstract, but I think you see this in a lot of things that the government does, not just the welfare state. You can even see this right now in the vaccine rollout. There's so much obsession with making sure that the wrong people don't get the benefit, that they create this amazingly complex system of administrative burdens on everyone. And not only does it slows everything down at a time when aid is deeply needed. And for any given person who's fallen into poverty or who's suffering, aid is deeply needed and very quickly. But it's just like in statistics, type 1 error versus type 2 error. If you clamp down on one, you get more of the other. So you end up with a whole bunch of people who actually are eligible for food stamps or for TANF or for whatever. And because they don't understand the process or they can't get the right paperwork or they miss the deadline or whatever, they don't get the aid either. So it doesn't just cut out the people who aren't supposed to get it. It even cuts out the people who are supposed to get it. That's the good faith analysis. The bad faith analysis is that that's intentional, right? That they are purposely trying to prevent people from getting on because they are considered undeserving. But I think like even if your good faith goal is to make sure the right people get it, you can see how just amazingly costly it is to do it in that way. And so that's why I think we're pushing for something like a UBI. That's definitely part of the discussion in the paper as well, in a different section.
Would you agree with the idea that there's such a thing as the right people, like maybe the people who are poorest, you would want to help those people the most, that kind of thing?
I don't want to go there. I don't think we should build a welfare state based off of like who deserves it. It should just be a right. You just get this. But when I am arguing with people who don't buy that, and that really isn't everybody deserves this as a right of residency or of citizenship or just being human. That's still a minority position, even on the left. And there's still like, we need to provide aid to the right people. And I point this out, like, well, let's assume that there is such a thing as the right people. I would like to show you that my approach is better at helping the right people by your definition than your approach is. So even if you don't agree with me that everybody should get this and that it isn't a matter of deservingness, you would be better served by going our way. So it's sort of it's a strategic argument, right? But I agree. I believe it. I do think that there's an enormous amount of administrative burden that has been foisted on people that just is counterproductive if you come from that world. If you're a liberal welfare state in the Espen Anderson sort of way, as opposed to something more like a universal sort of social democratic welfare state, I'd like to see us get to something more like a universal state, a universal welfare system.
I can answer your question quickly. No, I'm not a fan of distinguishing between the right people and giving some benefits and some another ones no benefits. No, I'm not a big fan of that. You might have guessed.
So this paper is primarily about using basic income, or guaranteed income is what you call it, and figuring out how it can be integrated into the welfare system, into the social safety net to strengthen that apparatus. Do you view that as the primary problem that basic income solves, that it makes the safety net more efficient and more effective?
The way we talk about it is that there is no safety net for just huge swaths of the population right now, and that it would provide that it would provide a more generous and less aggravating experience for those people who currently receive from the safety net, but don't get it in a great particular way. We think, although this is not necessarily the main reason why you do it, that a guaranteed income would also be beneficial to the economy in general. We point out in the paper that work-conditioned safety nets obviously fail during recessions. And that increases the agony for everybody, including for people who aren't sort of the primary beneficiaries of safety net policies. So we also see it as potentially having a great effect on the economy overall and preventing deep sort of economic catastrophes. I think there's a lot of other stuff that comes with that, right? Guaranteed income, UBI, has been thought of as a way of dealing with what is sort of a structurally racist system. It's one that can be empowering to women. And certainly there are feminist writers who write about it. They talk about work that is extremely important that's done around the household and childcare, et cetera, that is not currently compensated by the market. And this is a way to make sure that the important work of basically keeping society functioning is supported and compensated. It's a way to get rid of the current stigma that's associated with these sort of means-tested and targeted benefits. I think it's a way of combating what I think is a truly atrocious and sort of embarrassing level of poverty in a country that is the richest and most powerful entity in all of human history. So I think we could do much better. And I see this as a way of doing better. I don't know the story of how Michael came to UBI, but for me, I worked for years in conditional cash transfer policy and in microlending and doing evaluations on that. And I just kept coming back to, like, just give people money. Like, why are we making them jump through these hoops? Why are we doing this? They just give them the money. We know what that can do to people's lives. We know what it can do to help children as they grow up. We know the effects that it has long-term on health and on the criminal justice system. It just seems like a no-brainer. It's really just a matter of figuring out how to get to there. And that's sort of how I got involved in it.
I think all the reasons Steve listed are good reasons to have a basic income, UBI. But I guess if I had to choose the one that animates me most, first of all, it's, to me, a basic income, as we said, it's just the amount of money people get, whether they sell their labor or not, whether they are good people or not. It's just the grant they get for being who they are, right? I mean, there may be conditions on residency, things like that, but it's not work conditioned or any other kind of conditioned on good behavior. That's key to me, because to me, the main reason for basic income is something Steve said earlier before he made his last few points, goes back to this question about power. And so a basic income to me can be, depending on how big it is, right, can be a way to give workers, both as individuals, but also collectively, more bargaining power as they deal with employers who might try to dominate them or get them to work on terms they'd rather not work on if they didn't have to risk starvation by not taking the job. It's a way to give workers potentially more bargaining power, individually and collectively. That is the heart of why I support a basic income. All of you know my good friend, Carl Weidequist. He phrases this in terms of freedom as the power to say no. And that's roughly, I mean, I'm not saying the exact same thing, but it's close. I mean, it's pretty much the same thing. That is the core of why I support it. But I realize the degree to which it would do that would depend on how big it is. And I also think, coming back to the topic, a basic income in conjunction with other kinds of non-work conditioned benefits might play that same role. For example, a UBI and Medicare for All, right? Just to think those two together, like that might together play the same role, right? I mean, as long as people can get access to benefits that they can use to survive and pay their bills without having to subject themselves to the demands of an employer, that is why I support a basic income and other kinds of non-work condition benefits. That's at the core of why I support it. But there are other kinds of reasons, right, that are good ones as well.
So do you think it's normal for a society, for an economy, for a normally functioning economy, do you think it's normal for people to fall through the cracks? Some people are just going to fall through the cracks and have to be caught in some kind of safety net.
So that's a good question, because it gets into, say, like the macroeconomy. I'm not a macroeconomist, but you can look at Australia and see that they were able to go more than 20 years essentially without a recession. So I imagine that it is quite possible to produce a macroeconomic sort of policy, monetary and fiscal policy, that essentially prevents those sorts of events from happening, right? That you can create a stable economy. I'm sure I'm saying something terrible and my macroeconomist friends will yell at me, but my sense is that there doesn't need to be a boom and bust cycle. So that's one thing. But every household is subject to its own idiosyncratic shocks, right? People die or get injured, or they lose their particular job, or I have to stop and take care of somebody, or what. It's been really heartening during the pandemic to see everybody excited about, let's just give people cash and this is outside of people's control and let's help them, and sending out checks and expanding UI. I really feel like a dam has broken in a lot of ways. Like I hope it persists, but you know, now you're seeing the Democrats talking about adding in a child allowance and I think cutting back on a lot of the restrictions around EITC. Maybe not as far as I'd like to go, but at least they're starting to think about, why don't we just get more cash into people's hands and with fewer strings? But what I'd like people to understand is that people every day, whether or not there's a recession, like in their household, are dealing with stuff that's outside of their control that can lead them to lose their job or to have a huge expense or whatever. And there should be something there, I think, to catch them. Like I said, we can do better on a macroeconomic level to make sure that everybody doesn't fall at once. And that's certainly, again, from an insurance perspective, that frees up a whole lot of resources that could be used to help people get back up on their feet. But I don't think we'll ever be in a world where there aren't going to be illnesses and injuries and other sorts of shocks at a household level that people are going to need help with. And those people have the right to say, I think this was outside of my control, in the same way the pandemic was outside of everybody else's control, right? And I think I deserve, as a member of the society, or maybe deserve is not the right word, but as a member of the society, we protect each other in those situations.
Yeah.
It's not exactly eloquent, but there you go.
Something that strikes me from that, I mean, just to tie it to some of the questions in the article, is that I think it's relevant because a lot of people think about the social safety net as a cost to the economy. So food stamps or aid that you give to the poor or the suffering or people that fall in hard times, this is typically conceived of as like a cost that's worth paying. And so the idea is that, well, if you didn't pay this out, you know, the economy could prosper more. People could sort of be getting rich in the market, that kind of thing. But we're going to sacrifice a little bit of that to take care of the needy. There's a bit of a tension there that's introduced if you list in the benefits of basic income, not only is it a more effective social safety net, but if you also say, well, it might also help the macroeconomy. Like it might just actually help with this problem of recessions that we're having. If that point is true, if it's true that putting it in fixes some problem that we have going on with the economy, technically that would mean that this would improve our ability to pay out more conditional safety net features, right? If you're actually having the economy generate more stuff that can be redistributed, if it's true that basic income has a pro-macroeconomic effect in and of itself, that would change the way people would be looking at it. And I think this article is sort of taking it, and I think very rightly, taking it at face value, certain claims about, okay, we're going to imagine there's a budget constraint and now we're making choices. How do we make those choices? But it's worth considering, like, that might not be the right way to think about it. There may be another way of looking at that.
Yeah, I think happy, healthy people who there's a lot of research around, say, child allowances, that people who grow up not poor are less likely to have criminal justice involvement. They're healthier. They have greater educational attainment, all that. So like, to me, the idea that this is like a sacrifice that we're making, maybe it is in the short run, but in the long run, you have happy, healthy folks, like citizens or residents, is a good thing for everybody, I think. Less crime, fewer health problems. And then if you want to think of the economy as a machine that produces stuff, right? A more productive machine. So on some level, it's an investment, I think. Not that I think we should make our choices about whether we help people based on whether or not it increases the GDP, right? I think that maybe is a positive side effect, but I think like primarily we should help people because it's the right thing to do. But I also don't think that it's really, even in those terms, even if you are just like from a cynical, crass, like taxpayer perspective, I think you can make the case that there is a, you know, a return on investment. But yeah, that's not normally where I go to when I start thinking about why we need something like this. I don't know. What do you think, Michael?
Alex asked, was this normal? Like, that was the question, the word normal. That's kind of a loaded term. I think it's, I don't mean you being, I'm not attacking you. I'm just saying that term is interesting because, I mean, I would say right now it's normal for people, for most of us who are not independently wealthy, to get most of our income from selling our labor. Right now, that's normal, but it doesn't have to be, right? That's normal right now because we haven't decided to grant a UBI, right? Assuming we could grant one that was big enough that people wouldn't need to rely as much on selling their labor, then there would be a new normal. So I don't know if there's a normal meaning like inevitability in how the economy is designed. I think what's normal is to some degree based on choices. Now, of course, like, you know, the choices we make, they generate incentives and that affects behavior. So there are some constraints on what we can do. But within those constraints, I think what's normal or not for an economy depends a lot on what we decide. And right now we are deciding to make most people who are not independently wealthy rely on finding someone to buy their labor to get most of their income. We don't have to do that, subject to the constraints of how giving people money would affect labor supply, but we don't have to do that. So we could create a new normal. That's how I see the answer to that question.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer. And you basically caught me because I was asking a very normatively loaded question. So when I ask what's the normal way, I'm asking, how do you think things should work, right? And yeah, I mean, we expect people to sell their labor in order to receive income. And at the same time, we enact policies that try to create jobs for people so they'll have somewhere to sell their labor. And that strikes me as pretty inefficient and unproductive. A question we could ask is, I know we don't typically think of monetary stimulus and, you know, the Fed pumping money into the banking system as part of the welfare program, but to some degree, that is our largest income support program. People who receive this income don't think of themselves as being taken care of by the government or receiving an entitlement or something like that. But it works similarly behind the scenes. So I'm wondering if basic income can also be an alternative to that.
Good question. It's certainly the case if you follow economists like, say, Claudia Sam or whatever, that their sort of suggestion is that when the economy goes down, that you just send people money. That is not necessarily tied to a UBI, but we've spoken with sort of representatives in Congress and so forth who said, well, what if we do the Claudia Sam thing, but the baseline isn't zero? What if when the economy is not in recession, everybody gets guaranteed income, maybe it goes to a Fed account or something like that. And then when there's a recession, one of the primary ways we combat the recession is we turn on the money spigot, and instead of getting, you know, $1,000 a month, you get $2,000 a month or whatever it is, tied in some way to what the condition of the economy is. And then it can sort of tamp back down to whatever the standard sort of UBI is. So I think that this idea that once you have this sort of system in place, that it can also be used as part of macroeconomic policy to stabilize things. Oh, things are going down, tamp it back up. Okay, things are stabilizing, okay, tamp it back down. I think that's very interesting. We don't have the infrastructure to do that right now. And that's actually the subject of another one of our papers in the same series, which is how you would actually build the cash assistance platform and get money into people's hands. I'm happy to say that there's a lot of discussion right now about postal banking and Fed accounts and hybrid systems and all sorts of, and at the nonprofit level, people are trying to build cash disbursement platforms. So it's definitely a problem that people are taking seriously. And I think over the next several years, we're going to have the sort of infrastructure necessary to actually talk about this seriously, that we could actually do something like that. So that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, cool. We actually did one of these on Fed accounts where we talked about the Morgan Ricks proposal and all of that. So time flies like it always does. I want to go to Michael for final thoughts, and then Stephen, if you have anything to say, and then Derek.
Thanks for letting us come and talk about it. Hope more folks read it. And again, I saw the paper mainly as exploratory, raising questions. We offer answers, but it's mainly raising questions. I liked your questions and I'd love to get more. So that's all I got to say.
All right.
Yeah, thanks. I don't have much to add. I'll just say again, I think this is a very exciting time. There's a lot of pilots being launched. There's a lot of cash assistance that is, you know, again, not all the way to where we'd want it to be, but the needle has been moving a lot over the last few years. And it's very clear that people are sort of considering stuff that they haven't considered before. Imagine we were in 1996, there's TANF, and now we're talking about a child allowance that we just give people money. That's huge. Even though it's not enough, if it's not where we want to get to, that's really like a sea change in the way that we're thinking about the safety net. I can't predict where it's going to go, if things are going to fizzle out after this sort of round of reform, but I think it's worth taking a step back and saying, like, wow, like the narrative really is changing, and all the work around guaranteed income, UBI, cash assistance is part of that. I think we're doing something really interesting and big here. So yeah, I'm very interested to see what happens over the next few years, and I'm hoping that we don't lose momentum, that we can keep pushing.
Yeah, me too.
Well, thanks for coming on. Thanks for writing the essay. I wish we got to go over more quotes from it. The one point that I thought was very interesting the essay brought up was talking about basic income as being good at leveraging the market. Whatever the market is good at distributing, basic income can help solve that. And that was a cool conceptual category, whereas the other safety net services were for things markets couldn't do, right? And then there was debate to be had about what falls into those. So I like that distinction a lot. I'm looking forward to reading the next essay from more of the macroeconomic perspective too.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well. I think the main takeaway for me from this discussion is no matter what world we're living in, there's always going to be risk of some kind of, you know, people falling on hardship or something like that. And you're going to have some kind of risk pooling insurance program. And there's always going to be some form of safety net that handles those things. But maybe not some of the other stuff. Some of the cash assistance stuff can be simplified and made more efficient. And I think that's one of the main points that you guys were trying to make in the paper. And I think it's a really good point. So this is a great discussion. Next week, our topic is going to be nominal GDP level targeting. So we're going to get into some macroeconomics, and our guest is going to be George Selgin, who is the director of the Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives at the Cato Institute. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Take care.